Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, one bishop at the African Synod can't seem to get enough. He wants to come back for the Synod of Middle Eastern Churches next year. We'll tell you why. And we offer an exclusive interview with the new ambassador to the Holy See from the Netherlands. The Synod for Africa has entered its third and final week of deliberations here in the Vatican. One of the bishops attending the Synod has proposed that he and his North African fellow bishops participate at next year's Synod for the Church in the Middle East. Bishop Maroun Laham of Tunis, Tunisia, made the suggestion at the start of this month's Synod because he said relations between Muslims and Christians in North Africa are different from those in the rest of Africa. Bishop Laham would find himself at home in a synod for the Middle East. He was a priest in the Holy Land for many years before being assigned to the Diocese of Tunis in 2005. Well, I met up with him in the synod hall to find out more about his proposal. Let's listen. You were born in Jordan and spent many years in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem. So you have a unique perspective as a Middle Eastern Christian living in North Africa. You have proposed that North African bishops be included in the 2010 Synod for the Middle East. Why is that?
Yeah, the first reason is that we have many points in common with the churches of the Middle East, especially in terms of Christian minorities living there and in terms of dialogue with Islam. I noticed that in Europe and now also in Africa, we notice a fear from Islam. I think that the experience of the churches of the Middle East and that of the churches of the North of Africa living with Islam for centuries can give some light and some new point of view about how to relate with Islam.
Now, from the point of view as a Middle Eastern Christian living in North Africa, I mean, do you see differences between the relationship between Christians and Muslims in the Middle East and North Africa?
There is one main difference, is that in the Middle East, Christian minorities are local Christians. They are Jordanians, Palestinians, Lebanese, Iraqis, and Egyptians. While in North Africa, Christian minorities are foreigners. Nevertheless, I see that there is a certain acceptance in the churches of North Africa of Christian minorities, although they are foreigners. But the main difference is that the churches in North Africa are not locals.
Mm. So how can you have a dialogue between Christians who are not locals and the local Muslim population?
First of all, it's a dialogue of life. In many sectors of the life and work and families, in social life, Christians and Muslims mixed together. As for the churches in North Africa, we have many chances where we mix with Muslims and we live with Muslims. We have, for instance, our Catholic schools. We have 10 Catholic schools with 6,000 students. All of them are Muslims. So this is a unique chance to get in contact with Muslims. Dialogue in the countries of North Africa, except some exceptions, Algeria, for instance, dialogue is easy because Islam in North Africa is a moderate one. And Christians are so few that they represent no threat for the Islam or for the presence. And by the end, we Christians living in North Africa, we know that there are certain lines we can't cross, and we do not. So we do not represent any danger for the social or political stability in these places.
Yet one of the countries in North Africa, which I would imagine would be part of this initiative of yours, involvement in the Middle Eastern Synod would be Egypt, where there is a large Christian community to a certain extent, the Copt community, which is one of the most ancient Christian communities in the Middle East. Yet there is there have been growing problems between the Copts and the local Muslim, more fundamentalist elements in the society. I mean, how does that play into all of this?
I should ask this to a Coptic bishop. But as far as I know that Egypt is easily becoming radicalist in its Muslim positions. It's not mainly directed against Christians, but I think it's also directed against the political system. But Christian Copts also have some negative results of this Islam emerging in Egypt. Add to this that I think the majority of Coptic Christians in Egypt live in the south, where there is a big poverty. So they have problems dealing with Muslims, they had problems getting work, getting jobs, and many of them convert to Islam, not out of love for Islam, but to be able to find a job or to have a position. And now some of them who after want to return to Christianity find many difficulties to do this because the Sharia forbids this. So this is one of the problems of the Coptic Church in Egypt, but Coptic bishop will talk better than I do.
One of the big problems facing the church in the Middle East is the growing number of Christians who leave the Middle East for various reasons, for the violence, for economic reasons, for jobs, for school, and etc. Do you see that sort of phenomenon happening in the North African countries?
First of all, there are not various reasons for the immigration of Christians of the Middle East. The main reason is political. The main reason is the conflict which perdures since one century now. So once the political conflict between Israelis and Palestinians is solved, I think a big percentage of this problem of immigration will be solved. Now, we don't have this problem at all in North Africa yet. First of all, because we don't have native Christians. And our Christians in North Africa are foreigners who by vocation go and come. We change 25% of our faithful every year. Students, business people, diplomats, families, etc. So we don't have this. We have this at the level of the country itself. Most of young people, but they're all Muslims. They dream of going to Europe for a better life. But that is not the same problem that the one of the Christians of the Middle East.
Is there an association, particularly in the North African countries, of Christianity being associated with the Western colonial powers?
No, I think this is a problem now of the past. Most of North African countries are independent since half a century now. Yes, especially in Algeria, where colonialism was very strong, there is some. But in Tunisia, I don't find it, neither in Morocco. On the contrary, 90% of young people of Tunisia and Morocco, and even of Algeria, dream of having a visa for France or for Italy.
Christianity is so vibrant on the African continent, so much so that European churches are looking to Africa for priestly vocations today. Is Christianity making any headway in Northern Africa?
Headway, that means having converts. Tunisia and Algeria allow conversion. The problems are not political, are not constitutional. Problems are social and familiar. So the constitution of Algeria and of Tunisia allow a Muslim to convert if he likes. But there is such resistance from the part of the society and from the part of the family, which makes the thing a bit difficult. Nevertheless, there are some conversions, but we are very far of having a Tunisian or an Algerian local church. I think that for decades, unless there is a miracle, that for decades the churches of North Africa will be mainly foreigners.
And finally, what do you see as your particular contribution to the Middle Eastern Synod, representing the church in Tunisia and amongst your bishop brethren from North Africa?
Two things I think we may give. One is our special type of dialogue with Islam. I lived in the Middle East, and my dialogue with Islam was always centered on Palestinian Muslims or Jordanian Muslims. Now my dialogue with Islam in the north of Africa is a bit different. I'm Arab like them, but I'm not Tunisian. So there is, I'm not a part of the social milieu of Tunisia. And there is it's a interesting difference to be brought to the Middle East. And the second one is perhaps a bit egoistic. Not having local Christians in North Africa, we depend for the clergy and the sisters on Black Africa, and we depend also on the Middle East. So we will tell our brothers in the Middle East that the future of our churches depend in a certain way of their charity in sending us priests and religious people.
Bishop Maroun Laham of Tunis, Tunisia. The president of Nigeria's bishops' conference, Archbishop Felix Adeosin Job of Ibadan, says the Catholic Church is very active in interfaith dialogue in his country and that a special government-sponsored interfaith commission has been set up specifically for the purpose.
The Christians and the Muslims are co-chairmen of the interreligious dialogues. It happens that on the national level, presently, it is a Catholic archbishop, the Archbishop of Abuja,
who is
John Onayekan, Olufemi Onayekan. So we meet not only to discuss social matters, but also to discuss religious matters.
Bishop Robert Patrick Ellison of Banjul, Gambia, tells us he has found day-to-day relations most effective in advancing understanding between faith communities in this majority Muslim nation.
The way we are going about it now is perhaps in trying to create trust at a personal level. The idea of sitting down around a table to talk about issues is not the right way to begin. We are at the moment coming together, say, on occasions of the great Muslim feasts, the end of Ramadan and the Tobaski, the Feast of the Slaughter, on the occasion of the pilgrimage in Mecca. The bishop or the priests or some others will go to the imams on that day and share their joy and whatnot. And vice versa, at Christmas and Easter, they will come to us. I mean, I have got twice now a nice leg of mutton from the imam on the occasion of this, the Feast of the Slaughter, Tobaski it's called in the Gambia. So that's the level at which the relationship and the trust and the understanding against which we can begin to work on the tricky issues that come up in terms of marriage between Christians and Muslims, other areas of life where Catholics sometimes feel a little bit oppressed because there's Muslim mosques shouting us down and... But that's the way we are going about it at the moment. As I say, sitting down at a table to discuss whether God is one or God is three, and the whole question of Jesus as Son of God, those issues are important, but they are not really the heart of the matter.
Freedom needs to be anchored in truth, the truth of the nature of the human person. That's what Pope Benedict XVI told the Netherlands ambassador to the Holy See as she presented her credentials earlier this month. In observing the many opportunities for joint action between the Holy See and the Netherlands to promote world peace and prosperity, the Holy Father noted that such freedom needs to be directed towards the good of individuals and of society. Speaking of the current global financial crisis, Pope Benedict observed what he called the consequences of exaggerated individualism in the pursuit of personal advantage to the exclusion of other goods. There has been much reflection, he said, on the need for a sound ethical approach to the processes of economic and political integration, and more people are coming to recognize that globalization needs to be steered towards the goal of integral human development of individuals, communities, and peoples, shaped not by mechanical forces, but by humanitarian values that are open to transcendence. Well, I caught up with Ambassador Henriette van Linden shortly after she presented her letters of credence to Pope Benedict, October 2nd. I asked her to recall the meeting for us.
It was quite overwhelming, I can tell you, that we were very pleased, my husband and I, that we were allowed to take the children. I mean, they're grown-up young ladies, but they came over. They loved it. Their nanny came from Malaysia. She's a very devout Catholic, and she was thrilled to be there as well, and the staff of the embassy. You could describe the procedure as a procedure of great simplicity and enormous elegance. The beauty of it all. The meeting the Pope itself, of course, was for me a highlight. We had a very pleasant conversation about different issues which were mentioned in his letter and in the letter of the government that I presented to the Holy Father. And, so we were all very, very impressed and greatly honored that we could, all of us, the whole family, experience this.
In his discourse to you, Pope Benedict XVI said that the Holy See's diplomatic relations with states afford many opportunities of cooperation on important global issues, and it values and hopes to strengthen links with the Netherlands in the future. Now, how have the Holy See and the Netherlands cooperated on various social and humanitarian issues?
The Netherlands and the Holy See have many fields in common, fields of interest in common. We are, and we have been for quite some time, very active in development cooperation. One of the few countries, I think, with Denmark, that spends 0.8% of the GDP on development cooperation in Africa, countries in Asia. And, of course, through Caritas Internationale, we also contribute to the efforts that the Holy See puts in there. That is a very important field. The Holy See, we're very active in climate change, the environment. Human rights is one of the major priorities of our government, Minister of Foreign Affairs in particular. And in view of the fact that the Holy See stresses also the importance of peace in the Middle East, of course, I mean, the Netherlands has an involvement there as well, lots of activities and projects with the Palestinians, close cooperation also with Israel. And we all know the Pope went there just last May and stresses the importance of cooperation of the Arabs and Israelis, including, of course, the importance of interreligious dialogue. And that, again, is also one of the important priorities of my government. So we have a lot in common.
As Pope Benedict pointed out in his discourse to you, while some of the Dutch population call themselves agnostic or atheist, more than half of it professes Christianity. Now, what role does religion play in public life in the Netherlands? And is this changing with the rise of the immigrant population?
The Netherlands, I think you could describe as a liberal, open, secular society. Nevertheless, as you said, 50% of the population calls themselves a Christian. The larger percentage is Roman Catholic. In mind, in spirit, they may not always go to church, but I think they share the values. The Protestants and many non-sort of Christian people would actually also share a lot of values with the Roman Catholic Church, humanistic values. They internated these norms and values. And so we are a secular society, but I think with great attachment to values like human rights and respecting religion, freedom of expression. That is the situation. The last years, we see a growing population of Muslims. We have about 800,000 to 900,000people, Muslim people coming from originally from Morocco and Turkey. They are received, when it comes to freedom of religion, with open arms. There are 400 mosques. In my previous experiences as a director of the Middle East, I used to tell the Arabs, is visiting Arab countries, that there are a lot of Muslims in the Netherlands respected, and they have the opportunity to pray. We have 400 mosques. This is a point which I made during all my trips, if there would be any doubt about not respecting Islam. So yes, religion is there. It is very much in many cases, an individual experience. So church going or practicing religion is declining, but that doesn't mean to say that people do not appreciate the values, which are also appreciated very much by the Roman Catholic Church.
I know that the government of the Netherlands also, in some way, helps religious communities. I believe that the Pope himself mentioned it, that it supports faith schools.
Well, this has to do with our history. This financial support for Protestant, for Catholic schools, has been there for decennia, I mean, for a long time. So, yes, the state finances, we call them special schools, I mean, religious schools. And so this goes back a long way.
Now, Pope Benedict and his predecessor, John Paul II, have expressed concern about what has been called the de-Christianization of Europe. Do you see this happening in the Netherlands or more generally in Europe? And should this phenomenon be of particular concern, do you think?
It is a sort of trend in Europe. I would rather call it secularization, without, which does not imply that Christianity is losing ground. Maybe, no, because people and all the values of European society look at the preamble of the European, of the treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, although it doesn't have the word Christian written there, it has this tradition. And Christian values are of great importance. We have not become pagans or heathens, you know. It's Europe has a high standard of human rights. Human rights are also scrupulously followed by the church. So we label things differently. We are indeed in the Netherlands, but also in other countries. I mean, the practice of church going is indeed declining. And instead, you might see other forms of paying tribute to religion. And we'll see how it will develop in the years to come. It might be a cyclical thing. But for the time being, nevertheless, I mean, of course, there's still a decent percentage of people that do go to church. But this is a moment which will have its sequence in a different sort of framework. So we'll see how, what happens.
And what role do you see the Netherlands playing in Europe today?
From the actually the beginning of the start of the European Union, it was called differently then. Of course, we were with the first six member states. Considering our history, our open society, the importance of abroad for us, the importance for free trade, for fair rules, for international law, for us Europe is an absolute must. And we've gone through the motions of from 6 to 9 to 12 to 15, now we're 27. It's very important that we stick to these rules of great importance to an open economy, an open society, good governments, democracy, fighting corruption, rule of law, and Europe creates or has this, that basic basis. So we are now in a process of another enlargement. Hopefully, of course, we will end ratifying the Lisbon Treaty. That is the first step which has to be taken. And then there are discussions going on with other countries for enlargement.
Ireland was one of the last countries to approve Europe's new constitution, the Treaty of Lisbon, in a referendum this month that overturned an earlier rejection of the treaty. France and the Netherlands rejected an earlier draft of the Constitution in referenda in 2005, but have since ratified it. The treaty, which brings in closer EU cooperation and streamlines governance in the 27-nation bloc, must be ratified by all EU members to take effect.
Europe is an absolute must for us in a world that is globalizing, where big players are coming up, of course, like Brazil and China and India and Russia. The United States has its role to play. Globalizing an economy means that you have to be in there together and talking to the people and the nations who matter. So the Dutch have been always very, as I said, have an open economy, have lots of investment abroad. We are playing a role in the G20, and we are also underlining the importance of values which were also described by the Holy Father in his encyclical Caritas in Veritate, of human dignity and profit, not for personal gain, but to for human beings, for humanity to gain. So not as an end in itself, but a means to an end of greater happiness. So that, of course, would also be European, Dutch, and also the vision, I think, of the Holy See.
In, I think it was, what was it, in 2005, the Dutch rejected the draft constitution of the EU. Are they really committed? Is the population committed to the EU?
I think that also the subsequent events of the global economic crisis has shown that the European Union has its own strength with the euro and good rules and regulations on coping with open markets, with competition. Europe came out as a... of course, we are all affected, and the European Union was as well. But the strength of the European Union was shown through its unity. And I think people started thinking again about that. And I think also this played in when the Irish were going to say yes or no in the referendum. So that is the difference. And I'm having worked in Brussels and also in the Ministry in of Foreign Affairs on the Europe desk. I'm very pleased that we said yes. We in the Netherlands said yes, and also the Irish did. So let's hope that the last straw will be also, I mean, in good order, that the Czech president will ratify and sign the treaty.
The Czech Republic's President Václav Klaus says he is waiting for the Czech Constitutional Court's deliberations on the constitutionality of the treaty October 27th before he signs the ratification bill. Now, one of the issues of greatest concern to the Holy See is the respect, of course, for human life from conception to the moment of natural death. Does the Catholic Church have any voice in raising the ethical questions regarding life issues in your country?
Well, certainly the Church as such follows the line on the dignity of life set out by traditionally by the Roman Catholic Church, and the bishops voice that, and there is a discussion going on about this issue. At the same time, society having developed into a society where individual rights and are of great importance based on values which, as I said earlier, we very much have in different aspects very much have in common with the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church. Nevertheless, on life issues, the Netherlands developed a different course, which does not imply, of course, that we neglect the dignity of life and the importance of life of the individual.
In concluding his discourse to Ambassador Van Linden, Pope Benedict expressed his hope that the Catholic contribution to ethical debate will be heard and heeded by all sectors of Dutch society, so that the noble culture, he said, that has distinguished the Netherlands for centuries may continue to be known for its solidarity with the poor and the vulnerable, its promotion of authentic freedom, and its respect for the dignity and inestimable value of every human life. And a warm thanks again to Baroness Henriette van Linden, the new ambassador from the Netherlands to the Holy See. And I'm Tracy McClure, Laudator Jesus Christus.